This is our 11th session with Bob Carr, who's in Mumbai, formerly known as Bombay, and this is December 29th, 2008. We basically came to the end of our biological, chronological story with Bob Carr, explaining how he ended up in India and where he is today, and the last things he did with UG and his former lover, Paul. I want to start off this one, which may be the last session for a while, with a quote from an essay by Marshall McLuhan. Robert, when we talk about the mystical tradition, one of the categories for that is Gnosticism. You've heard of that term, right?
Right.
And in religious history, there are two kinds of Gnosticism, at least that's what McLuhan presents. And he says there are two systems of symbolism. One is vertical and one is horizontal. So I want to read his summary of another professor's book where McLuhan found it useful to use these definitions to lead to what he wanted to say. So he begins this. This is an essay written about almost 50 years ago. He says, Professor Mansell Jones, in his book Modern French Poetry, takes up this theme. It's called Manichaeism in this essay, but it's which is another kind of Gnosticism. So Jones takes up this theme with reference to two kinds of symbolism, which he refers to as vertical and horizontal. Vertical symbolism is of the dualistic variety, setting the sign or the work of art as a link between two worlds, between heaven and hell. It is concerned with the world as time process, and time is capitalized. As becoming. It is concerned with the world as the vertical school. It is concerned with the world as time process, as becoming, and with the means of escape from time into eternity by means of art and beauty. Vertical symbolism asserts the individual will against the hoi polloi. It is aristocratic. Yeats, W.B. Yeats, is the perfect exemplar. Horizontal symbolism, on the other hand, sets the work of art and the symbol, the work of art and the work of the symbol, a collective task of communication, rather than the vertical task of elevating the choice human spirit above the infernal depths of a material existence. In idealist terms, the vertical school claims cognitive status for its symbols, because the conceptual meanings attached to art are in this view a means of raising the mind of man to union with the higher world from which we have been exiled. So it's the idea of contemplating symbols that emanate something, that raise your spirit. Then he says, whereas on the other hand, the horizontal or space school, so not the time school, the space school, appeals to intuition, emotion, and collective participation in states of mind as a basis for communication and of transformation of the self. The vertical school seeks to elevate the self above mere existence. You know, as a side note, Gnosticism, Manichaeism, they consider this a fallen world. It's a trap. We need to get out of it. So the vertical school seeks to elevate the self above mere existence. The horizontal symbolists seek to transform the self and ultimately to merge or annihilate it. Then McLuhan says, Mr. Eliot's position is by no means simple. They're talking about T.S. Eliot. Mr. T.S. Eliot's position is by no means simple or consistent within itself. But as between the vertical and horizontal camps, his poetic allegiance is markedly horizontal or spatial. Then McLuhan says, to Catholics, for all of whom preexistence is nonsense, and Marshall is a Catholic, to Catholics, for all of whom preexistence is nonsense, the anguish generated over the problems of time and space, the two schools, and the self may well be baffling. However, if you are frantically concerned with seeking an exit from a trap, it is of the utmost urgency to understand the mechanism of the trap that holds you. Are you a prisoner of time? Then he quotes Joyce, where his character Stephen Dedalus says, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake, says the young ascete Stephen Dedalus. So are you a prisoner of time? Then that's an example. If so, there are specific dialectical resources which can conduct an elite few to the escape hatch. Or are you a prisoner of space? Are you a mechanical puppet manipulated by a thread held in remote, invisible hands? If so, if you feel you're a prisoner of space, You can learn the techniques of yoga or Zen Buddhism or some related mode of illumination which will show you the way. And he has way italicized. To learn how to make perfect your will, so this is still within the space school. To make perfect your will, you need to negate your own personality and to learn that detachment from self and from things and from persons, which reveals, that reveals the total illusory character of self, things, and persons. Existence is not so much an historical trap in time as a wilderness of horrors multiplied by mirrors. It's still the space school. Existence creates itself by an endless chain of suggestions ricocheting off each other, just as a simplest poem of the T.S. Eliot kind generates its meanings by spatial juxtaposition. So then McLuhan says, a Catholic poet like Paul Claudel, of course, is not bound by these dichotomies of space and time, the dichotomies of the vertical school and the horizontal camp. But all he has written is strongly marked by his keen awareness of the space-time controversies in art, politics, and religion. And he has, McLuhan has in brackets, to the European, the comparative American ignorance of these doctrines as elaborated in art is precisely what constitutes American innocence. Then he goes back to Claudel. He says, thus in his section, quote, on time in Poetic Knowledge, Paul Claudel takes up the space position, then appropriates the time ammunition as well. Claudel's thought and poetry obviously move freely in both time and space. So McLuhan is saying the Catholic can play with both schools, which McLuhan feels the two schools are embedded in the art, religion, and politics through sort of secret societies or elitisms, are embedded in the culture. And then McLuhan says, as a symbolist, Claudel avails himself to the utmost degree of the spatial techniques of inner and outer landscape for fixing particular states of mind. This procedure makes available to him all the magical resources invoked by the Romantic poets for using particular emotions as immediate windows onto being, as techniques of co-natural union with reality. So that's the space school. Then McLuhan says, but Claudel values equally the resources of dialectic and continuous discourse. He can therefore, now that, oh, I won't say anything. He can there, Claudel can therefore be both Senecan or symbolist and temporal, so both space and time. That would seem to be an inevitable program for any Catholic for whom time and space are not sectarian problems. Today, many thoughtful people are torn between the claims of time and space, and speak even of the crucifixion of intellectual man, he's quoting a book title, and speak even of the crucifixion of intellectual man as he is mentally torn in these opposite directions. As the dispute quickens, the Catholic is more and more reminded of the inexhaustible wisdom and mercy of the cross at every intersection instant of space and time. So the cross is a symbol of the intersection between these two schools. It's in neither. It's in the gap, sort of. These moments of intersection became for Father Hopkins, who was a famous Joyce scholar, became for him epiphanies. Then McLuhan says, it is not the purpose of this essay to explain the complex falsehoods of the time and space schools of aesthetics, religion, and politics. For a Catholic, it is easy to admire and use much from each position. But by and large, the vertical camp is rationalist, that's the time school, and the horizontal camp magical in its theory of art and communication. So, I find
okay,
this useful.
Okay, this can go on and on and on.
No, I finished.
Okay.
I finished. So,
I want... Yeah?
Go ahead, if you want to comment immediately.
Well, my reaction is that, you know, philosophy is one thing, you know. It's an art to be practiced, you know.
Right.
What I have understood from my conversations with Yuji is that what he's talking about is not a part of the system of philosophy. He's talking about the simplicity of living, how to live simply, free from the burden of thought. And philosophy is certainly thought, you know.
Yeah.
It's a system of thinking. And it there's no end to it. And every philosopher, every poet, every mystic, you know, it adds more to it, and it's just an endless structure that it's a form of entertainment for people, for philosophers particularly, who are trained to think in a philosophical, you know, logical way, you know, whether it's Eastern or Western. It's an intellectual discipline, and therefore, as far as I'm concerned, I just I'm not interested in it. You know, I'm not a philosopher, and I don't have the intelligence to be a philosopher. You know.
Can I jump in, yeah. Robert? I was investigating this with someone today, and it seems to kind of broaching the subject right now. So I wanted to ask you what you think. I was speaking with someone and investigating if you know, there's a life which just happened, which is a momentary, moment by moment, spontaneous expression. And then there's the mind, which seems to be involved in this recording of experience, articulating mm-hmm. experience, mm-hmm. reorganizing experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's a place where life and mind actually intersect, or if the mind is just alien to life and needs to be sort of turned off so that life can express itself.
I think that to answer this, if mind is a servant to the movement of life, then there's no problem. But when mind is trying to control life, then there's a problem. When the mind takes its rightful place, and like I have to be at the train station at 2:30 to catch a train. That's a mental process, and okay, that's going to get me to where I want to go. But when I'm thinking about what my wife is doing, or my husband is doing, or God, or something else, then all this is just an activity that's taking the energy away from the living organism, which just needs a certain amount of energy to function sanely in this world. So when mind finds its place, which is to be a servant of the impulse of life, then there's no problem with mind.
Yeah.
We have to go into the question of authority, Bob.
Okay.
Because authority seems to be the stumbling block we all have when it comes to this search that we have for the answers to the meaning of our existence, life, etc., etc. As long as authority exists in any form, that authority prevents any investigation into what we're looking for, because it blocks the investigative, you know, a question that we have. I want to know something, but if the answer is according to what the Buddhists say, what the Catholics say, what the Jews say, what the Muslims say, what the Zen say, then all inquiry has stopped. Do you follow?
Yep. Yeah.
I'm stuck in their reference. So if I don't have a reference, if I have the courage to question, you know, and leave it at that, I don't know. You know. Then there's the opportunity. There's a space there. There's a space there that will give you the answer you're looking for, which is not what you're looking for. The answer you're looking for is not there. The answer is to forget it. Don't make a problem out of it. Why are you trying to look at all this? As a means to perpetuate yourself, to keep yourself going, so you overcome death, the ultimate, the ultimate problem that human beings have? They don't want to die. They don't want to come to an end. So, if I'm free from the looking at for an authoritative answer, for an authority experience, for an authority in any form, then that problem doesn't exist for me anymore.
But is so it, I'm just. Is it possible to be permanently free, or do the impulses of the body just simply coming up from the more primitive parts of the brain continually perpetuate the desire to survive?
Of course.
And so there's it's not it is if you're in one of these bodies, it's not possible to be free of this this investigation of how to the mind's attempts to perpetuate itself.
Yeah. If by some chance, you know, that the linkage of one thought to another is broken, there's a gap, then the whole structure collapses. And yes, you will momentarily experience the need to survive just for the moment. And in the next moment, there's no connection going on. So you're free from that fear of coming to an end. It collapses. That's all. You see, what we're talking about is a state that cannot be described by the mind, by thought, by system, by technique, by authority. It doesn't exist. Okay, we're living in a linear world. I am this, I want to be that, I'm moving towards the future, and so forth. But what Yuji and a few other people are talking about is another world, a vertical world, so to speak, which has nothing to do with this linear world. It's outside of it. The linear world is a cultural world. It's a world of language, of custom, of experience. And it can't comprehend this other world.
Yeah. Well, I guess once someone has recognized what you're talking about, they're no longer a seeker. But as long as they're a seeker, this somehow taking this step.
Then we just keep looking. We just keep looking, and if we don't find it here, we look someplace else. And not if it's not there, we go on looking. We change horses in the middle of a stream, so to speak. You know. So if you see that seeking is not going to get you anywhere, it's not going to bring about what you think you want. If you question that seeking, you put it down. Once you've seen what seeking is, you won't touch it again. It's not the means to help you understand. It just adds one thought after another. It just adds more descriptions for you, more thinking for you, more thoughts for you. So at some point in my life, I can't say when it occurred, I saw that, and I said, I'm not going to look into what yoga offers, or what Buddhism offers, or what Zen offers, or what psychotherapy offers, or what this or that, or the latest fad offers. Because they come and they go. You know, let the gurus come and go. One year one is popular, in a few years it's all over and a new one comes up. A new boy comes to town. And once you've seen that, you don't touch that anymore. You don't go near it. Just forget it. So all these teachers and traditions speak from a level of authority. they're telling you what they say is true, what they believe, and they are telling you to ensure their own belief that they're right. That's the only reason they're talking to you, to convince themselves. Well, they wouldn't talk. So whether you're the Dalai Lama or the Pope or the Maharishi, this or that, you know, these individuals are speaking out of their own experiences, their own tradition, their own past, their own system of thinking that they've been trained to think in. And for me, all that is dead. It has no life. It's just a descriptive process. Yes, it can create experiences. Yes, taking psychotropic drugs creates an experience. Yes, fasting creates an experience. Everything we do creates some kind of experience for us. And if we're interested in the mystical experiences, then we have mystical experiences. If we're not interested in them, we have no concept of the mystical experience.
Are you familiar with a Sufi prayer that has something to do with the prayer has to do with the desire to alleviate the suffering of the absolute?
I can't recall it. No.
It seems to me that there's a for people that experience the spiritual impulse, regardless of how perverted it may become, due to the way that it gets processed by the mind, still there's this sense that somehow, you know, humanity's salvation is still possible, that somehow it's possible to work for the alleviation of suffering of sentient beings, and that at some point humanity will get smart enough to where There's enough awakened people that somehow the course of humanity turns around from one where we brutalize ourselves as we have been doing since the dawn of civilization, and somehow turn it around for all of us. That feels to me like a basic spiritual impulse. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Okay. I suffer. I suffer because human beings are brutal. The system I live in is brutal. I am brutal to the people around me. I have servants because I want to keep them in that place to assure myself my comfort. I'm concerned with me. Okay, I see by if I read or if I talk to somebody, I can see that, yeah, the world is a mess. Okay? What is my impulse, next impulse? I want to get out of it, right?
Yeah.
I want to transform it, right? I want to change it. I want to be something else other than the mess. Now, the wanting to be someplace else is the problem, is the spiritual problem.
So you have to
wanting to be somebody else, something else, free of, that creates the problem. The world is what it is. I never look at it as a fact, as an actual fact. And I want to change it. I am the world. I am the brutality. I am the murderer, the rapist. I am all that. That's what I am.
And
now,
that doesn't
if I stop trying to change that by moving away from it into some idea, into some system, into some experience, if I just stay with it right there, then there's a possibility of seeing it very clearly, and you won't touch it again.
Thank you.
The so-called spiritual is an invention of the mind trying to escape its sorrow. And the sorrow is its separation. And the separation has created all this brutality, all the wars, all the murder, everything. All the problems are created by that.
Can you envision a time, or is it not? Is it sort of maybe not even profitable to think about such things? But can you?
Yeah, just forget it. Hope.
Yeah.
Just put hope aside. I hope.
So,
in the
regardless
future
of whether or not humanity ever works out its problems, is not an issue that we should be concerned with thinking about.
It's not going to solve anything.
Yeah.
How are they going to solve the problem in Palestine and Israel right now? There's a war going on there right now. How are they going to solve that? There's Muslim and Jew. How are they going to solve that? Why is there a Jew and a Muslim? Because people belong. Why do they belong? Because they're stupid. Because they're not. They're culturally, you know, stuck in an idea. I'm a Jew. I'm a Muslim. I'm a Buddhist. I'm an atheist. Whatever it is, I'm this. I'm that. As long as there is a religion, there's going to be suffering.
And any baby, if it is a blank slate, born into that type of cultural conditioning, is going to perpetuate
right.
the cultural conditioning.
Yeah. It's already got the genes in its nature, in its biological structure. The genes are all there. Hasn't got a chance. Oh, Jesus. It's not a pretty picture. So, there is this, somewhere along the line, human beings discovered that they're stuck. They're destructive. They're this, they're that, whatever it is. And then they said, there must be a way to change that, And out of that has religion was born, psychotherapy was born, one system after another was born, and so forth. And so, you practice something. You, like the Buddha, he practiced meditation and found out, dead end.
Yeah.
And when there was a final giving up, the surrender. Here's where the Sufis come in. The surrender. The real, true surrender. Then there's the transformation takes place. But that surrender, there's no way to surrender. How do I surrender? How do I surrender to the idea of surrender? It goes on and on, It'll drive you to the brink.
Well, I've heard the Dalai Lama say that, he wishes he could get out from under the mantle of the responsibilities that he has as the Dalai Lama, but, and he looks forward to the day that he can slip away from all of that, he seems to be obliged for some reason to continue to do what he does, and there's a need for it, I think, and he feels that need among the people who expect him to do what he does.
Yeah, the Catholics have a need too for a pope. It's no different. Tibetans want their Dalai Lama, which is their pope. And the Christians want Jesus. Jesus is their symbol. And the Indians want their temples with all their thousands of gods and goddesses. They have to have that. Without it, what are they going to do? How are they going to live without their gods? They can go to the temple and pray. Pray for this, pray for that. If they don't do that, what are they going to do? Are they going to grow up, maybe? But I doubt it.
Well, I think it was. I think you discussed it earlier in the talks with Bob. But did UG was being set up on a similar track as JK to be to head an order or something?
No. You know, he grew up in that atmosphere where there, all that was there, all that authority. And there was the world teacher business theosophy, all full of the hierarchical gurus and so forth, a secret teaching, all this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all this religious lore. And he freed himself from it.
Do you feel that it's there's any possibility that of continuing to have some sort of a camaraderie with UG? Now, I mean, he's dead and gone and so on, but if there's this vertical axis outside time and space, I guess, outside the mind, then from that space, can you still relate to UG as a some kind of a being or soul or entity or person or something, personality? Or is
UG is just as much alive now as he was when, you know, he was living?
Yeah, does that imply some separation, though, if you would say that UG...
I don't feel it. I don't feel that, because all the time I spent with UG, I never envisioned the idea that I was going to be with him forever, or he was going to be talking to me forever and ever and ever. I respected, you know, that situation that you have to be even free of UG. He used to say, you have to get UG out of your system. Okay, he's that body died, but what I understand, what I have understood, is part of me, is living in me. And I can't but help, express it. It's part of me. Mm-hmm. So how can I get UG? I can get the human UG out of my system, but that quality of that intelligence will always be there, always be there. And it's in everyone. Someone's breathing heavily.
Well, thank you for that, Robert. I don't know where. I appreciate all of that. I don't know if Bob is. Bob, are you still there?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It wasn't me. It wasn't me breathing.
Where's Bob?
Well, I was watching two spirits probe along the garden path, the questions garden of eternity.
Yeah.
There was a walk along the river with two souls discussing what is.
Well, actually, I thought that since we might not be, we're not going to be having a session for a while, you're taking off to Thailand, I thought we should turn the tables. And, I mean, Bob Dobbs has been examining you, Robert Carr, and I thought we should turn the tables and examine Bob Dobbs for a moment.
Yeah,
I mean, you've established a relationship with Bob that goes beyond the recordings that we've done here, and I was wondering if you have any thoughts or reflections on if you had any way of probing Bob for a moment or two, or if there was anything there to probe.
Well, we haven't had, like, you know, a personal get-together particularly. Bob is trying to bring out of me my experience, my life, what happened, and my life can offer some individuals some idea that maybe their own life is okay, they're on the right track, so to speak. I often get, not often, but I get mail from people who say after reading my book, they really appreciate what I have expressed because it's so similar to the way they are themselves, how they feel. And of course, you know, this is kind of a pat answer. I guess everybody can say that if you read a Catholic book and you're a Catholic, you'll say, "Oh, it, you know, this has helped me understand my Catholic reasoning and so forth." Well, that's not really a totally true answer there or statement, but in some way. Like Yuji said, he went away. He went to Shimla, which is north of India. Which is a kind of a British hill station. The British built, you know, 100 years ago. And he said he just wanted to get away from people. He was just tired of talking. He said,
Just a minute, Scott, you have to move your mouth away or nose from the mic. Your breathing has been fun, but we have a break from it.
Anyway, he got a hotel there, and I don't know if he was by himself or Valentine was with him. But anyway, he said he was there for a short time, and he said someone knocked on the door, and when he answered it, they wanted to know if he was Yuji. He said yes. So he said he welcomed them into his parlor. He's like the spider welcoming in the fly to his web.
Yeah.
And he said, Yuji said there was no escape. They find you. They talk to you. You resonate something, and they sense that. So he said, life will bring them to you. He said he doesn't have to have a PR, public relations man. Life will bring people, you know, of their own interest. So I find myself, you know, meeting people, and some people are trivial and blah blah blah. Others suddenly will become quiet and seem to probe and want to know what's going on. So then you start talking and you have some kind of a dialogue that's significant in different ways. So we're all, you know, being used in some way. Life is using you to further this knowledge, this information that one has. See, life is a total process. It contains everything: the good, the bad, the beautiful, and the ugly. Everything. And that stream of consciousness contains the spiritual, the non-spiritual, the religious, the non-religious, the philosophical, the non-physical, you know, everything, the scientific, the metaphysical, everything is there. And there's no truth, one truth. It's just that. That's all it is. So, the idea of one truth and everything is spurious. It's a figment of man's hopeful imagination. That he can say there's a fundamental particle where it all sprang from. The Big Bang, boom. Where did the Big Bang come from? My question. That hasn't been answered, you know. Because the question's wrong. It's a lineal question based on a beginning and an end. And I can't conceive of anything that's endless or without beginning, or what the Buddha called samsara. It's just a movement going on. So, I don't know, am I getting where I'm going to, where I'm going with this?
Well, in Yuji's case, I remember him saying that, you know, he stumbled into it, or he didn't know if it was accidental that he was able to wake up. You know, trying to extract oneself from the mind is like one of those Chinese finger puzzles where you put your finger and you, the harder you try to pull your fingers out, the tighter it grips your fingers.
Right, exactly.
And so it appears to me that the mind is not capable of liberating itself.
No, it can't. It's not the instrument. Yuji said, I discovered the mind was not the instrument to free myself, to free itself.
Yeah.
So if you see that, then the whole mental thing collapses. You don't struggle with mental abstractions anymore because it's not the instrument. And there is no instrument. Right? No instrument. So that leaves you where? In a very, very precarious state. And ultimately that would lead to a surrender. I just don't know. Knowledge comes to an end. And if you're lucky, in Yuji's case, he said that if you're lucky, he said, you know, this takes place. Someone asked J.K. how he got in that state that he talks about. And he said he doesn't know. Suddenly, I found myself on the other side of the river. And I think that's probably so very true. It's not a process. It's not a thing that happens. It's just one day you wake up and you're awake. And there's no how you awoke.
It almost seems predestined in a way, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yep, true. Maybe the genes. Yuji said, he said a number of times, it's predestined. So what chance have I? You know? I can just try to simplify my life, find out what it is I really want, and live within the means of my means of living, what I have, not try to struggle for something outside of what is reality. And if my life is somewhat more simple, I'm more relaxed, the body is healthier, the burden has been lifted somewhat, so you know, I sort of feel immensely blessed by having met that man and hanging around him and discovering that he took away from me the things I don't need. He pointed out, he didn't take them physically or mentally, he pointed out, do you need this, do you need that, are you really, this is this important? And as you look at these things, and as you free yourself, as you become detached from these things you think you need, life becomes quite simple for you.
Was there a transition where you felt you were with Jay Krishnamurti, and then you were with Yuji Krishnamurti, and I'm curious about what caused your allegiance to change, or was there anything about Jay Krishnamurti that you ultimately decided that was needed to be discredited as a result of having met Yuji?
No, I never felt that way. JK was able to very elegantly and very clear intellectual way describe the human condition and suggest that there was a way out of that, out of the mess of the human condition. But I couldn't find a way out. I came to the end of my tether with JK. Then I met Yuji, and he pointed out the same thing, that there was no way out of it. And one had to see that. And gradually, hanging around Yuji, I got a sense of what he was talking about more. And it didn't discredit JK in any way, but J. Krishnamurti is a grenade that goes off in your mind. Yuji is an atom bomb that goes off. So that's the difference. And that's probably because Yuji just kept his audience very small, to 10 or 12 people at a time, and never went for the big show, the auditorium with full of people. He tried it once, and he did one public talk, and that was all. And then he said no more after that. Not that he couldn't mesmerize people with words. He could easily. But JK talked about the condition and in a way offered a carrot. There's a way out. And I questioned that after Yuji, and that way out, that carrot, has disappeared. I'm not looking for the carrot.
Do you have Yuji's realization?
No.
But he sets you on your course to...
Yeah. All of us will have our own individual expression. Every flower, every snowflake, every grain of sand is different. And no two people are the same. No two twins are the same. So... whatever happened to Yuji and will not happen to somebody else. If it happens, it will be something different. Some different expression will take place. What that is, I don't know. No one knows. The life, the intelligence is so awesome and profound. Each moment is something new. What exists gets destroyed, and what happens next is something entirely new. That's the beauty of it, and how scary that is, because it destroys everything around you. And if that destruction takes place, something new happens, something totally different.
So it becomes a series of atomic bomb moments?
Yes.
Yeah, you're talking about life, not Yuji, in that last sentence, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Life and Yuji, I don't see the difference. Yuji was that life. There wasn't any man there anymore. Oh, memories were there. He was this, he was that. But when you were around him, this expression of life was bursting forth.
Oh, I see. So you were describing UG. It's just that you were talking about how every moment's different, something new happens. That's the way it was with UG?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the way life is.
That's the way life is, yeah. And human beings try to prevent that. They want to make it static, stuck, straight, you know, possess it, hold on to it, keep it. That's what relationship is and all this, you know. It's a mess.
Okay, Scott, I want to interject here. I quoted that that section from McLuhan's essay because when you say the world's a mess, and I'm not saying that you believe it's a mess. That. Yeah, he says it's a mess. That's a slang way of saying that that it reflects the tradition of Gnosticism and Manichaeism, and those philosophies say that we need to get out of this situation.
Well, it says it's a bad situation, and the human response should be, or has been, how do I get out of it then? In other words, okay, look at it this way. I can tell the story. I was talking to J.K. In a small gathering in Gstaad in 66, and I asked him a question, and I can't remember what I asked him, but he said to me, "Look, sir," he said, "you're walking along a path in the jungle, and you meet a man, and he says, 'Hello,' and you say, 'Hello,' and you." He says, 'Where are you going?' And you say, 'Oh, I'm going home.' And he said, 'Oh, but you're going the wrong way.'" This is the part of the guru. He says, "Yeah, you're going. That's the wrong way." He said. Then J.K. said, "What do you do?" And every time I tried to open my mouth, he said. He shouted at me, "Sir, sir, sir, what do you do?" And then finally he said, "For God's sake, you stop. You stop walking the wrong way." So, if we want to clear the mess up in the world, we stop adding to it.
Okay, what? So Robert, yes, but Robert, that's the assumption the world is a mess.
The assumption. Well, all the religions, all the philosophies, more or less, and the psychotherapists, all more or less, describe this Adam's and Eve being expelled from the Garden of Eden, okay?
Yeah.
This myth, and living in a contradictory world after that. A mess. Okay?
Right.
So more or less, the religious idea in Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Muslim, whatever it is, all suggest that we're not functioning properly. We can function differently, right?
And that suggestion has been reduced to a popular song now.
Yeah. What is it? You ain't gonna get it?
Yeah, can't get any satisfaction.
Right, right. That's why it's so popular. That's why it hits you. Because you say, "God, really, right. As soon as I have sex, I want to have it again."
Okay.
I had a beautiful dinner, and I want to repeat it again and again and again. I saw a pretty face, I want to look at it forever. Huh?
Okay, we can continue that, but I just want to go back to this quote. So, in the public image of Krishnamurti, not that he was that, but our perception of him, and most people saw this, he was of the time school, that the choice human spirit could get out of this, and he was, quote, an elitist. And what's interesting is that UG, as you present him, though I know UG is more than that or less than that and doesn't exist, but in the presentation of his style, and you mentioned this in the book, he was the opposite of Krishnamurti. And so he would fit into the space school. He lived in the ricocheting and mirroring of the horrors of existence and talked with it in the street, so to speak. So I brought the quote because the two styles are probably eternal in human solutions. Like politics is of the space school to the degree it goes in and activates and tries to help people. Yeah, little change here and there. And also is cynical at the same time, knowing that it's providing the illusion of change, knowing that people won't change, but you still tax them and still pretend you're doing something for them. And then there's the educational or the church or the monks that withdraw a little bit and offer the time school. So I just thought it was interesting.
But they're offering basically the same thing. It's just a different venue. Venue, that's all.
And so what's interesting about McLuhan is that he says the Catholic sees they're both, quote, ridiculous. But he becomes a Catholic. Now, he was a different kind of Catholic in the way he was a Catholic. He certainly wasn't the same, but he did express some kind of thought ritual, even though he would say it wasn't thought. But that was as far as he could go in being a UG or a Krishnamurti. He remained in a public institution. He didn't offer himself as a guide outside the public institutions. Yeah. So it's interesting to look at McLuhan as a put-on and to see how he's a put-on like UG and Krishnamurti were. Now,
By put-on, what do you mean?